I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Some people like to deep clean every Saturday morning. I prefer to spend a few minutes every day keeping things fresh with Lysol. Lysol's disinfecting wipes conveniently tackle surfaces, including remotes, tablets, and smartphones, killing 99.9% of viruses and bacteria. Don't just clean, Lysol clean.
Hulu is coming in hot this month with new shows, new movies, and all new seasons of your faves. Don't miss FX's Clipped, the story of one NBA team's racial reckoning, starring Lawrence Fishburne. Stream a new season of Shoresy, the underdog hockey comedy that might just knock your teeth out. Then catch the high-speed drama Ferrari, starring Adam Driver and Penelope Cruz. Kick your streaming into high gear this month with so much new stuff to watch on Hulu.
Welcome to Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber, the cricket podcast where we answer your questions. And the best way of doing that, if you're watching live on YouTube, is, of course, to put in a super chat. But any comments and everything else is welcome, depending on how much time I have. But if you want to get your questions in beforehand, the best way is to support us on Patreon, which is patreon.com/Jared Kimber. And if you head over there, you can ask your questions beforehand, like John has. Who says, what would we see happen if we used a red ball in white ball cricket, excluding it simply being harder to see? Well, yeah, day-night cricket would die, John. So that's an easy one. The ball would swing for longer. It would seam for longer. It would stay hard for longer. It would bounce more, you know. So there would still be boundaries, but they would, you know, you would be taking more risks. If you used a Jukes, it might still be swinging at the 20 over mark, although probably the amount that you're hitting it would still soften it a little bit more than a normal red ball would have, would be my guess. Anyway, but yes, all those things are very much part of it. So yeah, runs should come down, wickets should, in some ways, the harder ball should be easier to hit for fours and sixes towards the end. So maybe what you would get is more runs in the death if teams weren't bowled out. So maybe a higher variability of, you know, games where teams are bowled out for 60 and 120 and, you know, 93 and those sorts of scores. But maybe also periods where at the death, without a soft ball, teams just absolutely crush it if it has stopped swinging and seaming and those sorts of things. Probably the sort of low action bowlers would be a little bit less. So that Partharana, Tashara, you know, some of the more low arm spinners that we've seen, they are all really helped by that white ball. So yeah, I think there's a few big changes. They won't do it, but they should use the pink ball. Many football clubs are originally cricket clubs, which play football in the winter to keep their players fit. AC Milan, Aston Villa, yeah, heaps of them. All of them very quickly drop cricket. Why? We didn't have an English cricket Premier League. Why didn't we have an English cricket Premier League 100 years ago? Was county cricket too strong? County cricket was massive. I mean, county cricket really remains massive up until what? I'm trying to think. Maybe when is 80s into 90s, there's a bit of a transition. The overseas players start playing in it. which I think also tells you how big it was. But it was just a huge endeavor, and there was lots of money, and there was, you know, crowds, and it was already organized and it was working. Coming up with something else, we did. There's probably, if it was going to happen, it's probably, and I can't remember that sort of AC Milan, Aston Villa. AC Milan formed, when were they formed? By the way, AC Milan should release cricket kits. So it was 1899. Yeah, so that's a little bit later. So if you look at, there was a period from probably the 1850s to the mid-1880s where there were like weird independent cricket sides. And, you know, the first touring team from England was sent to Australia was, you know, professionals. So that was kind of like a team. There were all these traveling teams that would play in the UK. We then had a women's version of it as well, which we've got a podcast on very soon. So, there were all these random franchise type things, but they were more like one-off teams, but there was a bunch of one-off teams, if that makes sense. That was probably the bit where we would have got, if they'd have continued to be successful, and I'm thinking of, I forget, was it the All England team was one of them? There were heaps of them, and they all had like slightly separate, different sounding names. I think if that had got bigger, you probably then would have had maybe more a chance of a more franchise-based thing. But by that stage, 1850 to 1880, the biggest cricketer is W.G. Grace. He's playing county cricket. You know, he's involved with Gloucester. He's involved with Lords. He eventually becomes involved with the forgotten county team. Were they a county team? But they were a first-class team anyway. The one in Crystal Palace, London County, I think they were called. So at that, if he had gone off with one of those sides and started playing with them instead of that, and a few other players had done that, because there were some other big name players that actually were playing in those leagues. But I think if him and a couple of the other biggest names had all gone off, or they had all formed their own sides, I actually think that cricket it wouldn't have been a franchise, but it would have been more private ownership. It would have been more star driven. It would have been certainly not county based. And it would have gone off in a completely different direction. I couldn't even tell you where it would have gone because there were crown, I can't even say it. There were clown cricket league games. So there were like cricket teams of clowns that would travel around and play. There were actors cricket teams. There were authors cricket teams. So there, you know, as I said, there was the there was the one league, which was two teams of the original England lady cricketers. Then there were spin-offs of that. So there was about two or three semi-professional women's cricket leagues. You know, there were like Harlem Globetrotter-like leagues. There were all these I keep saying leagues. Leagues is the wrong way of putting it. It is teams. But these things kept happening and would travel around. It could have gone in a very, very different direction. But by that point, county cricket was really big. And so these were seen as more entertainment. There could have been, the one thing that makes me think of it is perhaps that sort of, I'm trying to think of another league where this happened, which is perhaps something like what happened with the NBA. So you had the ABA and the NBA, and the ABA was the entertainment league and the NBA was the proper basketball league. And then they kind of combined them, and that's what the NBA is now. You know, it's much more of a entertainment package than European basketball is, which is much more pure basketball, right? Perhaps if that happens again in that 1860 to 1885, 1890 sort of period, things would have happened. But I also think that England was changing very, very dramatically at that point. I think the industry around that kind of stuff was dying on its own. So it would have needed W.G. Grace and George Lohman and whoever else were the, you know, the biggest names. Was Haywood around at that point? It would have needed a bunch of those guys all to sort of go across and almost form a breakaway. And they probably could have got more money if they'd done that, if we're being honest. But it would have been risky. Cam says, do you think it's a coincidence that the two most dominant teams in Test history, 80s West Indies and 90s 2000s Australia, had the dominant bowling but no real bowling all-rounders? Or does it speak to the importance of frontline stroke bowlers that an all-rounder may be able to mask over? And of course, the best would have both. if you put Keith Miller in the Australian team or you put Garfield Zobers in the Australian team, they would have been better, right? So I do think that your point is really good. And I've talked about it before that the two greatest teams of all time didn't have all-rounders. But you can make a claim that maybe the next three teams did. So it does go in a different direction. I think if you have Glenn McGrath, Jason Gillespie, Shane Warne, and the backup bowlers that Australia had, and I think if you have Kirtley Ambrose, Courtney Walsh, Joel Garner, Marshall Holding, blah, 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 then you don't need an all-rounder as much. You know, if you look at the West Indians, they were strike bowlers and stock bowlers all in one. Glenn McGrath was a strike bowler and a stock bowler. Warne was a strike bowler and a stock bowler. That's not always going to be the case, right? To have that many options that can do both, I think is, it's a huge thing. And so generally you would want it. Australia did have all-rounders available to them in the War Brothers at various times. Michael Bevan bowled a little bit as well. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else. Yeah, that was probably the majority of the bowling that they had. Oh, Andrew Symonds would have been the other one, right? So they had a little bit. And Viv Richards bowled and Carl Hooper both bowled stock overs for them. So they did have fifth bowling options. But what they didn't have, and what you're saying is, they didn't have that sort of Keith Miller, Sobers, Kapil Dev, Ian Botham, Freddie Flintoff type of player. And that's very, you know, Jadeja, Chucky Balasan. They didn't have anything like that. That's right. But it, this is why I think there's an obsession with all-rounders in cricket. And you end up usually with players who aren't particularly that good when you're obsessed with something, right? There's a reason why left arm pace in T20 cricket has a very similar record to right arm pace. It's not because left arm pace isn't a huge advantage. It is. It's that we're so obsessed with it. We go out as far as we can to get left armers from everywhere who aren't actually that good. And it's the same thing with all-rounders. We do the exact same thing with all-rounders. We're so desperate to have an all-rounder in these teams, we end up with lesser all-rounders. If you think about the Australian lineup, you had six frontline batters, your wicketkeeper was an all-rounder, and four frontline bowlers. All those six batters could average 40-plus with the bat and sometimes 45-plus with the bat and sometimes, you know, hovering around 50 with the bat, you know, a great amount of them. With the West Indies, it didn't matter if you had injuries because you had backup bowlers and backup bowlers and backup bowlers available to you almost at all times. And then you had, you know, a very, very good crop of six batters as well. Maybe not quite on that Australian level, but not far off it either. The chances of you having, what, five guys who can average over 40 with the bat and three guys who are strike bowlers and stock bowlers available in one team is quite rare. So, and it makes sense. Also, it's better if you have an all-rounder because you can give your guys a proper rest. Callis gave the other South African bowlers more of a rest, right? You know, that he only bowled 22 overs a test, right? But it meant that they didn't have to come on for that second spell at the 15, 16 over mark because they had another bowler who was not going to waste the new ball and would probably take some wickets as well. And they got that, and they got that extra option. That's a huge advantage, right? You know, and so these things do matter, but if you're in a situation like the West Indies in Australia, you may not need that because everything else has already fallen into place for you. Zatchbo says, is David Frost's reputation as a writer and editor diminished by the episode as editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly when he published the notorious article by Robert Henderson with the title, Is It In The Blood? And was hostile towards West Indies tourist sides. So I got a bunch of old Wisden Cricket Monthlies and the stuff that was written about the West Indies is, it's horrendous, right? It really is horrible to read. And I do think it's affected David Frost's reputation going forward. The Robert Henderson article was more famous at the time. And then from that, maybe people like me have gone back and read some of David Frost's previous stuff. But he had an issue with the West Indies. He didn't like the way that they played cricket. And he also printed a piece that was so racist that they were sued easily and lost. So, you know, a court of law said that, I think it was Devin Malcolm and Phil De Freitas who sued them. There was, I think it was an out-of-court settlement in the end. So yes, that I think that has affected David Firth's legacy. I think he's a complicated person. I think you'll find most cricket historians are complicated people, and it's not always a racial thing. But you know, it's a weird niche thing, and the people who get really obsessed over these sorts of things, and I would certainly put myself in that. You know, odd and probably you know, come out of it weirdly. He was on the wrong side of it, and he was on the wrong side of it for a very, very long time. And I think there were reasonable cricket arguments with the West Indies that could have been made at that time, you know, about the overrates, for instance, about the bombing of tailenders and things like that. But it would be hard to watch what the West Indies were doing and not be absolutely amazed with what they actually managed to, the way they played cricket and the way they transformed cricket. And he seemed to not do that. So if you're a historian, and I've told the story before about John Woodcock. I met John Woodcock really early in my career. And the first question I asked him was about Basil de Oliveira. And I said, tell me what you wrote about Basil de Oliveira. And he went really quiet. And he said, yeah, I was on the wrong side of that. And it really taught me a lesson of, you have to try and get on the right side of these things. And I don't mean that from a legacy point of view or anything else, but like, this haunts you if you get something wrong. And if you just go with the flow, which is what John Woodcock said he did, he kind of believed what he was being told by his people on the inside, and he got on the wrong side of it. It really left a huge impression on me. And I think if David Firth had his chance to go back, he would write about the West Indies really, really differently. But he did it for a very long time. And the Henderson article, as you've said, is you know, a part of it. And I think it's one reason why David Firth isn't talked about as much now compared to you know, some other people who wrote about cricket, is because he got that wrong. You can say that there was a racial element to it as well, which in the modern world is even worse. But it doesn't really matter if it was racial or not. He was a cricket historian at a moment when the game was changing, and he was not really, he missed that whole opportunity to write incredible stuff as something was happening, you know. And so there was a point at which a lot of people, you know, would have got frustrated with me writing so much about the English team since 2015 to now, that I could see the England team was changing cricket, and I was way ahead of the curve. I had English writers saying to me, stop talking about them. What are you doing? It's just a flash in the pan. I was like, you have no idea. They are literally changing the way that this sport is going to be played. The wobble ball as well, right? These things change our sport. And so as a historian, you have the chance to do that. To be on the wrong side of that, as Firth was, or to not notice it, or to moan, or rather than be a historian, which is someone who's talking about the effect that is happening, I don't know. Then you throw in the racial part of it. And, you know, I think that's kind of the death knell of that. Look, I don't know Firthy particularly well. He's a very, very old thinker when it comes to racial identity and religious identity. Like, you know, the brief conversations I've had with him, he still supports that he was right to put that article in from Robert Henderson when I talked to him about it. So, you know, it's not like he's coming out and saying he was wrong. Like, It's a hard one, but there will be a time when everything I have written will come back at the same stage. But it's up to me to grow and go, well, that was wrong, or here's why I wrote that, but now I look at it and I shouldn't have written that, right? And there's plenty of stuff that I wrote that I shouldn't have written, right? Especially on Cricket with Pauls, which was absolute nonsense, right? And some of it was intentionally nonsense, if that makes sense, which is a little bit different to what he was doing. But the point is, you wouldn't do that anymore, and you have to be honest with those sorts of things. But as a cricket historian, I think the most important thing is you are archiving the game. And I think that was his biggest failure. And if that comes from a racial blindness or an anger that the game was becoming West Indian rather than Australian or English or whatever it was from, he's got to own up to that, and it has tarnished his legacy. I've probably talked more about David Firth than anyone has in quite a while. We'll have a quick break, and then we'll be back with more Wagon Wheel after this.
This is brought to you by Cricket 8. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. We have a partnership with them where we host live watch-alongs, do podcasts and write articles. If you want to know what is really happening with our game, visit cricket8.com.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to recognize the undeniable cultural influence of Black musicians, composers, singers, and songwriters. From folk music to rock and roll, jazz, and more, Black culture has shaped almost every genre of music that exists today. Join State Farm in celebrating this month and beyond. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hulu is coming in hot this month with new shows, new movies, and all new seasons of your faves. Don't miss FX's Clipped, the story of one NBA team's racial reckoning, starring Lawrence Fishburne. Stream a new season of Shoresy, the underdog hockey comedy that might just knock your teeth out. Then catch the high-speed drama Ferrari, starring Adam Driver and Penelope Cruz. Kick your streaming into high gear this month with so much new stuff to watch on Hulu.
All right, welcome back. Satchmo says, would you always pick Lara ahead of Viv for a test 11, or would it depend on the playing surface and composition of the attack? Would I pick Lara ahead of Viv Richards? Yes, because Lara can do what Viv Richards did, in as much as he can score at the same rate that Viv Richards can do, but he didn't always choose to bat that way. And I think there's a big difference there. I think Lara was... Richards was a better player in pace and Lara was a better player of spin. But I think Lara was a better player of pace than Richards was a player of spin. Not Richards was a bad player of spin, but I think Lara is probably, you know, top five, perhaps, players of spin of all time. So I think that's a completely different level than where... I think Lara was a great player of pace, I should say. Got that all confused in my head. And I don't know if Richards would be thought of as a great player of spin, just a very good player of spin. I think that I would. But I suppose if you were going up against the West Indies fast bowlers, would you pick Viv Richards over Lara? Perhaps in that kind of matchup? And as you say, depending on the playing surface and composition of the attack, I don't think Lara loved playing the hook shot particularly all that much. And we know at times, you know, Glenn McGrath worked him over. So, you know, you might pick Richards in certain situations. But if you didn't know anything about the conditions of the game going in, I think Lara is better. But there's not much between them. I think that's really important. I don't know. I'm pretty sure Lara's going to end up in our top 10 batters of all time when we finish our book. Viv Richards is close, but I'm not sure he's an automatic top 10 batter of all time. Ian says, you've spoken often of early English cricket where the batters were gentry and the bowlers were working class, and that is undeniably true. Is there anywhere else in the world where certain types of people were more likely to perform certain cricketing roles than others? Yeah, it goes all the way through, Ian, really. If you want, South African cricket is a perfect example of that kind of still happening. You know, we hear these stories of young South African cricketers coming through who are black, who have batting talent and sort of get pushed into bowling because of their athleticism. So that still happens. Trying to think of, you know, I think you'll find that a lot of the best batters in the world come from, in a lot of different countries, come from elite schools or big cities. And a lot of the bowlers come from more regional areas and maybe are more naturally athletic or have natural skills that get them at the top level. I think that's pretty standard everywhere. I mean, Sri Lanka is a perfect example of most of the batters come from like two schools, right? And most of the bowlers come from random places from nowhere. Suddenly someone's playing in a playing with a tennis ball, and then they pick up a ball for a fastest bowling competition, and then they're playing for Sri Lanka a little bit a while later. Pakistan would be another one that would be similar to that, I would have thought. I'm trying to think about India's pattern. I don't know if it's as blatant as some of those. West Indies and Australia is probably a little bit more mixed, I would have thought. But I think if you really drill down, that pattern might be there. Although Australia's had some pretty good batters come from nowhere, haven't they? Out of the country at times. You know, Mark Taylor, Slater, Phil Hughes, Bradman. Yeah, so there's a few there. So maybe it's not as strong. But I still think if you really drill down on it, I think there'd be a little bit of nugget of truth there. It's very hard to be a great test batter if you don't come from a place with incredible training facilities, conditions, pitches, access to coaches and everything else. It's not as hard to be a great bowler if you don't have those. If you are incredible, you have some incredible physical skill or athleticism or whatever it may be that allows you to bowl fast or get extra bounce or swing the ball both ways or whatever that may be. So I think that generally holds true. And then also, I'm trying to think of, there's probably like micro versions of this as well, Ian, but I'm trying to think of how they would come across as well. But yeah, I think there would be micro versions also of that. Rudra says, West Indies have a seam bowling attack of Alzari, Shamar Joseph, Holder and Shepherd and Russell for the T20 World Cup. Are they lacking in specialist seam bowlers? I feel like their bowling attack could end up being really embarrassed even in their home conditions. So we did this on TalkSport when we were commentating the England-West Indies series. And I said that they've got this stupidly great lineup of right arm seam bowling all-rounders. So Alzari and Shamar, obviously, let's take them aside for a moment. But Alzari's not a locked-on T20 bowler. And Shamar Joseph, we know how much talent he has. But, you know, played in one IPL game, and that one over was one of the most remarkable overs I've ever seen in my life in every single way. But then you've got Holder, Shepherd and Russell, who are all right-arm seam bowling all-rounders who probably don't have a great role in a T20 bowling plan that isn't, they should all probably bowl in the middle overs. So they're going to have to bowl Shepherd up front. Generally, that's what they try and do. They will probably try and bowl Holder or Russell maybe a little bit more in the death. Both of them can be good pinchy death bowlers, but they both go for a lot of runs. But if you bowl Holder and Russell together, the one thing I would say about them at the death is they both usually take wickets. So they might be, as a combination, quite handy if they can, for every four overs they bowl at the death, they can take, you know, one or two wickets each if their spinners have done a good job earlier on. But yeah, it's not some of the great, you know, I think we underestimated some of the great bowling lineups that the West Indies had prior in their great sides. I think there's a lot of good hitting in their batting. I don't know. I love Puran and Hetmeyer, but I think everyone else is good rather than great. But there's a lot of them. Oh, by the way, Robin Powell is another right arm seam bowling all rounder. So yeah, the specialist seam bowlers might be a problem. Akhil Hasan can sometimes pinch hit as a death bowler. So there's that. But yeah, it feels a little bit lopsided to me. I think that's probably fair. Josh says, middle order. Imagine you're writing a book on the top 50 batters of all time. I will imagine that. Coming to all good bookstores near me, 2025. What year are we in now? Yeah, that one's coming out in 2025. I think I'm right with that. Do any of the following batters fail to make the top 10? Ponting, Callis, Tendulkar, Sobers, Sangakkara. Ponting's not in the top 10, I don't think. Callis, Tendulkar, Sobers, Sangakkara, I think are all in. Well, Tendulkar's definitely in the top 10. I think Sobers is definitely in the top 10. Sangakkara's in the top 10. And I think Callis is in the top 10. But I can't remember off the top of my head. But Ponting isn't. Ponting's a little bit further down. James says, Lance Morris still hasn't been picked in a test and his form seems to have settled down a bit from that which inspired the hype a year ago. Is he going to end up as the next Brad Williams? I.e. doesn't get picked until he's lost a yard or two and injuries to frontline quicks make him next in line. This actually happens quite a lot. Ben Hilfenhaus, Sean Tate, Brad Williams, as you mentioned, You see it in places all around the world. When they're really, really fast, they're really raw, and there's sometimes just other bowlers in front of them, and so they don't end up in the side. And you hear, you know, the problem with bowlers is that they physically develop maybe at maximum pace. So not everyone, but a lot of them physically develop maximum pace, maybe around 22 to 24, but they don't have many other skills. So Mark Wood might be another example of that. I don't think Mark Wood's slowed down as much as some of those other guys probably did. Sean Tate was definitely quicker before he played for Australia. And a lot of people in Shield cricket will tell me Ben Hilfenhaus was. And I saw Brad Williams, that one. Him and Brad Williams and Sean Tate, there's no doubt about it. The thing is that there aren't that many express fast bowlers who are successful just by being express fast bowlers in Test cricket, right? You do usually need some other skills. And so teams usually don't press the foot down on that. Ruja says, from the Crick Pickers episode about all-rounders, I started to think that India have been trying to use Shardul Thakur as capital dev in England, in that he bowls outswing and can bat in an attacking manner at number 8. What do you think about this? And how do you think India would use capital dev if they could call upon him now? Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're trying to use him as capital dev. But yeah, you know, they've used him in South Africa and England, haven't they? He's probably played tests somewhere else as well. But yeah, their idea is that his particular kind of bowling will transfer to those locations, and then they get a little bit of batting. You know, I think there's a lot of people who think Shardul is an all-rounder. He's probably, I think, proved that that's not the case now, but beautiful striker of the ball, and he causes absolute chaos. And we're all here for that. But because he has a good ball, a good best delivery, he's a very smart bowler as well. Like, he's just not talented enough to put the ball where he wants to put it, sadly for him. But his best ball, you don't get that many kind of all-rounder players where their best ball is killer. You get more all-rounder players where their best ball is, I don't know, like a Maharoof. What was the Ashraf, the Pakistan, those sorts of guys, where they're like, their best ball is nagging. Andrew McDonald type bowlers, right? It's harder to find the guy whose best ball is killer, like that Moeen Ali type of bowler. And that's probably where Shardul fits in a little bit more, even if his batting isn't at that level. How would you use Kapil Dev now? Kapil Dev would just be in the side. I mean, Jadeja would be at 7. Kapil Dev would be at 8. Ashwin would be at 9. And then Bumrah would be at 10. And I don't know, they could pick a bloke off the street as their fifth bowler if they wanted to. You know, they could do whatever they wanted with their fifth bowler and it wouldn't matter. That lineup. Because you've got Jadeja's probably, all things considered, a better batter than Dev. But Dev has that ability to smash the 70 balls in a test match. And if he played now, it'd probably be 70 or 40 balls the way that he played. That can change everything. You let him bat at number 8 and he probably goes on to be the best number 8 ever. Apologies to Sean Pollock and Daniel Vittori if they are listening. But yeah, he probably goes on to be the best number 8 we've ever seen in this modern side. They get a genuine new ball bowler, which they give him the new ball in India. And then when they travel around the world, he gets the new ball. And you don't have to over bowl him. The idea of him being over bowled, as I've said before, is not quite true. But you don't have to over bowl him in other places. And then you've got, Mohammad Shami or Mohammad Siraj or Ishant, you know, depending on which era you're dropping him into as another bowler. There's some of those guys. Maybe Siraj doesn't work at first change as much, but Ishant at first change, Shami at first change. I like those as your first change options. And then, of course, in India, you can pick a third spinner as well. Like Kapil Dev allows for so many different things. He's a potential match winner at number 8 with the bat, and he would be useful bowling in India and everywhere else. He's a really good cricketer. Let's have a quick break, and then we'll be back in a moment with more questions here on the Wagon Wheel.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you.
Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Hulu is coming in hot this month with new shows, new movies, and all new seasons of your faves. Don't miss FX's Clipped, the story of one NBA team's racial reckoning, starring Lawrence Fishburne. Stream a new season of Shoresy, the underdog hockey comedy that might just knock your teeth out. Then catch the high-speed drama Ferrari, starring Adam Driver and Penelope Cruz. Kick your streaming into high gear this month with so much new stuff to watch on Hulu.
Josh says, opening batters. Imagine you and a friend had to sit down to talk sport, and he likes attacking openers and suggests Hayden and Sehwag would be the ideal combination. Do you pick Gavaskar as the most statistically impressive of the TV era, or does classic Kimbo kick in, reminiscing about pre-World War One? So I didn't realize this was up. Is this me and Bumble have been doing some stuff for Talk Sport together, and one of the things that we are trying to do is pick our ultimate 11. And it's not necessarily the greatest side of all time. I think that's fair to say. We both feel very strongly about cricket in certain ways. And if I remember correctly, John Norman also said we couldn't pick Jack Hobbs or those sorts of players in the lineup. And the one thing, I was in a lucky position because I'd interviewed Bumble for my book, so I kind of knew the kinds of players that he was looking for. And so he really liked that sort of Hayden Sehwag opening partnership. I think we might have settled on Gordon Greenidge and Sehwag in the end as that opening partnership because they're the most disruptive and would cause the most problems. Also, I think in Bumble's case, if you look at his favorite batters of all time, I think it's Lara Sobers and Viv Richards. So you kind of know that the kinds of players he's going towards. But I made a case for Gavaskar or boycott and those sorts of players based on their record. But as a selection committee, and you know, I've been on actual selection committees, like from club cricket all the way to international teams. You have to come up with a theory that works as a selection team. So I still held firm on certain players, but once we had decided that we wanted that sort of more of an attacking style of 11, you're in a situation there where that's how you picked them. And that, so what you were seeing with me and Bumble is really more how selections actually work. We came up with a theory of how we thought we wanted our team assembled, and then we found the best players from that theory. It does not mean that we've ended up with the two best openers of all time, because that is not actually what we are trying to do in that situation. We are trying to match our idea of how cricket should be played with the best players from that. So it goes in a slightly different way. But yeah, you do things with Bumble, it's going to get random. Jessica says, read the Mark Butcher interview on Reading. If you haven't heard it, it's really cool. The sound quality is a bit dodgy. I apologize for that. But it's really cool. It's about a time when he went out to bat when he knew he wasn't at the level he needed to be for Test cricket. Anyway, how difficult is it to make your interviewee feel comfortable and safe in your presence, so they'll open up to you about their genuine feelings, beliefs and memories, and not just give you a bunch of worthless hollow boilerplate? Look, there are some people that just do that automatically. I remember years ago I did an interview with Phil Tufnell, and he thought we wanted the sort of Phil Tufnell type of interview. And about 10 minutes in, you could see him realize that we'd actually done an awful amount of research, and that, you know, I think it was me and Sam Collins who were interviewing him for an old Crick Info podcast that I don't even think exists anymore. But he suddenly realized that this was a genuine interview, and so he had to change his tone. And I suppose that's where I try and make sure really early on that they know that. So, you know, I've been interviewing a lot of people for my book recently, and I want them to know really early on that I don't just want them to tell, I don't want them just to tell me that Sachin Tendulkar was great. That's not going to help me. I want them to tell me why they think Sachin Tendulkar was great, or what their relationship was to Sachin Tendulkar, or how he batted, and why that matters. You then have a situation where you can find something in them that they want to talk about. So one of my favorite interviews of all time was Shane Warne. Very similar to the Tufnell one. Shane Warne came and he thought he was going to answer the same questions. And he sort of started with the same anecdotes. And then suddenly, I think it was me and Dan Bredig. I think that's right. Me and Dan Bredig are both leg spinners. So we start asking him nerdish questions about leg spin. Shane Warne just opened up in a way that he doesn't usually talk to non-cricket people about. And I learned something that day, which was that Shane Warne isn't usually asked about leg spin. Shane Warne is asked about being famous. He's asked about winning games. He's asked about being Shane Warne. He's very rarely asked about being a leg spinner. When you start to ask them about the thing that they are interested in, right? The thing that they don't talk about all that much. It's a whole different level. When people ask me to be on their podcast, I say, come up with questions I haven't been asked before. If you ask me what it was like to make Death of a Gentleman, I have answered that question 25 times. You are just going to get an answer, right? If you come up with a question or a subtopic that I really like that no one ever asked me questions about, you're probably going to get a much better podcast, right? And it's the same with that. And I remember that day with Shane Warne where we finished and then Shane Warne was like, oh, I could have done this all day. We could have kept talking. And I did a similar podcast with Ricky Ponting where I asked Ricky Ponting about technical stuff about ODI batting. And I must have had Ricky Ponting sit down for like an hour and a half and he was still loving it at the end. And we turned the camera off and he kept talking about it. Because he doesn't get to talk about that. And so that's always my thing. And so, look, I'm friends with Mark Butcher. I'm probably much better friends with him now than when we did that interview, but I knew him then and I knew him well enough. And I don't know if it made the cutting room floor of that podcast, but one stage he goes, you know me. That helps, right, in a situation like that. But also, I'm not doing news stuff, all right? Once they work out I'm not doing news stuff and I want them to talk, they will talk. I've still had some really bad interviews. I'd say on Red Inca, the one that just we, you know, Chris Broad and I just didn't work. It didn't work. That's not having a go at Chris Broad. It might've been my fault. It could have just been that we didn't connect, but I just couldn't get Chris Broad to talk beyond the sort of normal stuff that he talks about. And maybe it was on me as a researcher that, you know, I didn't find the connections that I need to, but that's my big thing of, what would this guy want to talk about? And sometimes you go in with heaps of stuff and then you get there and they don't, and that's not the thing that they want to talk about. And you have to let them guide you where they want to go. And sometimes that's hard because you might've told an editor or a publisher or whatever, you know, you might have but usually if you allow them to talk about what they want to talk about, they go into a different place. Be prepared to say things that are wrong. I think that's the biggest one. Sometimes I interviewed Mark Waugh last night and there was something I knew that he wouldn't like to hear, but I wanted him to rebut it. And if I put too many layers on it, it would sound like me trying to, I'm trying to think of the best way of putting this. It would sound like me trying to be on his side and he would have just agreed with what I'd said. So I kind of had to phrase it in a way that I didn't agree with. In fact, I remember there's a coach of a national team who like reacted really poorly to one of my questions once. And I sent him a WhatsApp afterwards and I said, you realize I agree with you, but I needed you to say that, not just agree with me. And he was like, oh, he said, you got a really good answer there. I said, I got a fantastic answer. You couldn't have. So sometimes you have to kind of be the person who says the wrong thing in that kind of way to get them to that point. There's a lot of it in my Fans with Laptop course about that. But I really think it is, you work out what they want to talk about. And then if you can go with that, you can get anyone to open up. And then you can always pop in your normal questions at the end, right? You know, the stuff that you need to go back with. Once you have opened up a human being to talk, that is the key. Everything from there comes off that one bit. Jessica says, the current state of affairs with the top test team snubbing and ignoring the bottom test is getting just ridiculous now. It's funny that you say current state of affairs. Go back and have a look how many times the old cricket teams used to play. It's exactly the same. What if, financial and logistical roadblocks notwithstanding, the bottom test teams just circumvented the snub and started playing lots and lots of international cricket amongst themselves? What I would give for a Zimbabwe versus Ireland 5 match test series. Yeah, it's kind of what they should do. The problem is that there isn't a way for them to make money off that. So I don't know as much about Zimbabwe's finances, but I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying this, and I certainly am for Ireland. If Ireland played Zimbabwe in a 5-test match series, they would lose a lot of money. So that's not going to happen. The way that it should have happened, Jessica, is that they should have done a league, World Test Series league with two divisions, and then this would have happened automatically, and the money would have gone up because of the overall rights package. That is the way to do what you wanted to do, and the smaller nations voted against it. Not Zimbabwe and Ireland, or I'm not sure about Zimbabwe, but the, more that sort of West Indies, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh teams. I can't remember if there was anyone else. But there was a few teams who were like, oh, what if we go in second division? Yeah, that's how sport works. Play good sport or you go down. Naveen says, with fast bowlers being so prone to injuries, have cricket boards invested enough in physios and technology to biomechanically analyze and correct bowling actions to prevent injuries? Is that something possible in current times? Are cricket boards lacking in this aspect? And if so, should they be doing more? I'd say Cricket Australia has probably been at the forefront of that, and they never got Peake, Cummins, Hazelwood, Stark, and Pattinson on the field at the same time. They've been doing biomechanics since the 90s, Academy of Sport in Australia. Most countries now do it. I think there's some issues, and one of the issues is that we don't have enough biomechanical information going back far enough to know that if we should be making tweaks or not. I've had some arguments with some people who are very biomechanically, very biomechanically obsessed or you're professionally involved with. And I think part of the problem is we don't have as much historical data going back. The other problem with cricket bowling, let's just stick with the fast bowlers, as you said, Naveen. Geoff Thompson, Glenn McGrath, Malcolm Marshall, Kapil Dev, Mark Wood, Jofra Archer. Are they not all different kinds of athletes and have completely different kinds of bowling actions? What's right and what's wrong, I think, is maybe a harder answer than other things. And I think that is a huge part of why we have them. I also think that the front foot no ball law is a major culprit. I think if we went to the back foot no ball law and we fixed the dragging issue, we would have fewer injuries to fast bowlers. We created an impact that we did not need to create, and it has caused a big issue in the physiques of bowlers, in the physical part of bowlers. I think that's a bigger issue than the cricket boards and everything not getting on top. Physios are probably one of the first things that came into cricket in the professional, that sort of first bit of professional. And then from that, Australia had the Academy of Sport and the biomechanics. Those have all been in from the 80s and 90s. Have they had as much money spent on them as what the basketballs have? You know, there's this great... there's a book on, and I've forgotten the name of it now, but it's a book on sports science that I read a few years ago, which talks about how they could tell from the way, it must have been a basketballer because it was jumping. They could tell from the way that basketballers jumped where their injuries were most likely to happen. I think we're at that point in cricket as well. But fixing it and going against muscle memory and all these sorts of other things causes other problems. And we've seen bowlers, you know, James Anderson is a perfect example of the biomechanics weren't quite right and they tried to fix them and it didn't work. And there was a whole string of bowlers that they tried to fix biomechanically and made worse in England specifically. Plus all those Australian bowlers were always injured. So fast bowlers get injured and it is part of it. I think, honestly, the future of fast bowling is probably more like baseball platoons than anything else. I think that's probably where we're going. Vicar says, could you explain what is different between a strike bowler and defensive bowler? I heard Hardik and Andre Russell are strike bowlers. I tend to think they're getting the wickets because batters attack them too much. What lengths would you bowl as a defensive bowler and an attacking bowler? What's the best way of putting it? Okay, so if Andre Russell bowls at the stumps, and he bowls regular short balls. So he is not hiding the ball outside off stump as much as a lot of other bowlers might be. He's not bowling defensive, slower balls to get singles in the way that other bowlers are. He's bowling specifically high yield balls that are likely to get wickets and go for runs because he's not a particularly great defensive bowler. Hardik Pandya is very similar. Again, short balls, again, is a big part of his diet. Neither of them are probably accurate enough to bowl wide Yorkers, and neither of them have great slower balls. And I'm not saying that they don't have slower balls, because Andre Russell certainly has a really good slower ball, and Hardik can bowl slower ball, but they don't have Mohit Sharma or Andrew Tai slower balls, right? Or Dwayne Bravo slower balls. And so they have decided that their method of being useful is in taking wickets. So they are bowling lengths and lines that should get them wickets, but won't necessarily keep the runs down. So if you compare that to Sunil Narine, Sunil Narine is a great example of a defensive bowler. Sunil Narine's best ball is an off spinner that goes onto the thigh pad of the batter and doesn't allow them to sweep. It doesn't allow them to come down. If they slog across the line because of the length that he bowls it, there's a fair chance they'll get a top edge and it'll go straight up in the air. The best shot off that ball is turning it around the corner for one. It's a genius bowling move, right? Because he gets so many more singles than other bowlers because he is bowling a lot. But it's very hard to get a wicket off that ball. As I said, if you try and slog it massively across the line, you might get a top edge. If you pick it early enough and you can get inside the line, sometimes you can tap it past short, fine leg. But it's not an easy boundary ball. And so he's going to get less wickets than a normal bowler bowling that ball. He hasn't bowled as much this year, but have a look. Seventh over. He's been doing it a lot in the fifth and the sixth over as well. He comes on and he bowls at that thigh pad. He's not trying to take wickets at all. Compare that to Chakravarti, who is a much more wicket-taking type of bowler and much more of a strike bowler. Chakravarti is trying to hit the top of leg or the top of off on almost every delivery, right? Attacking the line, but he's also bowling into the arc of a lot of players and he's going to go. Krunal Pandya, Jadeja, they are trying to bowl low arm action, slide it, so it's very hard to get under them. That's a defensive way of bowling. Chahal is bowling up out of the hand and coming down. That's an attacking style of bowler, right? It's hard for Chahal to get dot balls if he's not ripping the ball past the bat or beating someone in the flight, right? Whereas these other guys are bowling four dot balls, and when they get wickets, it's when the match situation dominates, says that you have to attack them, or it's on the wickets that absolutely are ragging and you're going to struggle to stay in against them at all. So it's about the way the ball comes out of your hand. It's about your plan. It's about what your stock ball is and everything else. So yeah, they're very different. That's a fantastic question though, Vikas. And it's funny. It's one of those things I would have thought was really obvious. And when I got your question, I was like, I can understand why most people wouldn't get that. And it doesn't make as much sense. And, you know, maybe it's something we should make a video on the channel and on the main channel. But thank you very much for that question. I will take another short break here. And then when we come back from the break, we will go to the questions in the room. This is Wagon Wheel. I am Jared Kimber, and I will see you in a few moments.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Hulu is coming in hot this month with new shows, new movies, and all new seasons of your faves. Don't miss FX's Clipped, the story of one NBA team's racial reckoning, starring Lawrence Fishburne. Stream a new season of Shoresy, the underdog hockey comedy that might just knock your teeth out.
Then catch the high-speed drama Ferrari, starring Adam Driver and Penelope Cruz. Kick your streaming into high gear this month with so much new stuff to watch on Hulu.
All right, welcome back. We've got a few questions, one super chat and a couple of other ones. And wishes, can the T20 World Cup add more teams and maintain healthy competition? Or are Uganda, PNG, Canada already out of their depth? Same question for the small 10-team World Cup. How will 14 beyond affect balance? In the short term, those teams will be worse. But we've never had 14 good teams before, and we do. So we're already at an advantage. And how do you think those teams got good? It's by giving them money and letting them play and getting here. What is a healthy competition? I watch the Football World Cup and I see absolutely pathetic teams go up against other teams, and people still love the World Cup. Some of the greatest moments that have ever come from Olympics have been Eric the Eel and those sorts of people, right? I never really understand this question, because there's always one-sided games, even when we haven't. And I think it was Andrew Nixon did a study years ago that said that there is almost as many one-sided games between the top teams as there are between the top teams and the bottom teams, right? The truth is, the more that you bring more sides in, the weaker those new teams will be. That's fair. But they will get stronger. If this is ultimately a sport for the world, it needs to have more teams in it. You cannot have a World Cup with 10 teams, especially if you're the second biggest sport in the world. What a shocking indictment on what cricket has become, right? A gentleman's club that you could have, that we're having a World Cup and we could only find 10 teams we deemed worthy to turn up. Fuck off, right? That's why we don't have USA and Argentina, right? We've had good sides before around the world that we let go. We need to get better. And if you, Anwesh, have to watch a couple of games where Canada aren't particularly good, that's okay. Right? Because it wasn't that long ago that the Netherlands weren't very good. It wasn't that long ago that Ireland was shit. Right? It wasn't that long ago that Scotland wasn't particularly good. Right? Namibia. Look at Namibia in 2003. Look at where they are now. Cricket is in a better place because we are at least trying to open it up, and more countries are getting involved, and more places are getting involved, and more genders are getting involved, and hopefully eventually more people with different abilities will get involved. All these sorts of things. That's where we need to get. If Canada gets punched in the face, that's fine. Piss off, Canada. Next team. They'll get a chance. That's how it should work. That's what sport should be. Isaac says, why is Stark struggling so much in the IPL? Because he's been struggling with the white ball for quite some time. He was struggling in the World Cup. He struggled. He got dropped. Did he get dropped during Australia's last World Cup in T20 cricket? Is that right? I'm trying to think if he got dropped or if he just lost the new ball. Certainly one or the other. He certainly lost a new ball at one stage. So he's lost his automatic role. He wasn't instantly thought of to be a frontline player for Australia. He then went to the World Cup and didn't bowl particularly well throughout the majority of the tournament. So why is he struggling? All of that. If you want the technical reasons, I've talked about it heaps of times before, Isaac, but very, very briefly, he went away from bowling pure swing and went to the wobble ball, and he doesn't swing the ball as much as he used to. He's not quite as fast as he used to be. And he's never had a great slow ball or anything else. So his main skills was probably swinging the ball early on and then reverse swing later on. There isn't as much reverse swing now because of the change to the cricket balls and the change to the laws and saliva and people are actually watching. All these sorts of things are happening. And so a lot of the things that he did brilliantly before, he no longer has access to, or the game has changed around him. Cyber Junkie says, you mentioned chucking is pretty common. Then why are teams complaining against Narine, who's obviously chucking each time he gets hit after a boundary? I mean, you want to say allegedly they're Cyber Junkie. Just so, I don't know if people know this. In many countries, calling someone a chucker is libelous and you can get sued. I mean, I'm assuming Cyber Junkie is not your correct name. But, you know, you don't want to be in a situation where that can happen. Chucking is really common. Why aren't teams complaining against Narine? Because they probably have bowlers who are chucking as well. That's why it's, you know, if we had sensors on the arms of every bowler, it would happen 5-6 times a game and it would be a no ball and we would all move on with our life. If we want to, we have the technology and the ability to fix these problems and we are not using it. And so that's why it's happened. You know, and when you say he's obviously chucking each time he gets hit for a boundary six, I haven't seen that, to be honest. But I do think lots of finger spinners specifically have an issue where their arm does straighten more than 15 degrees. And I think it happens to fast bowlers a lot too. Wrist spinners, medium pacers, maybe less so. But finger spinners and fast bowlers, I think, quite regularly break this. The interesting thing with someone like Narayan's action is because of the way he bowls, it's really way more obvious. My guess is you're watching heaps of bowlers, Cyber Junkie, who are doing this, right? This is the point. It should just be a no ball. We have built this up into this ridiculous thing. People's lives have been ruined over this. And that's why it's libelous, by the way. It really does affect, future earnings for people. There are people who've lost their entire careers because of allegations, probably in some cases that weren't even true. There's been a racial usage of it at times as well, right? We can fix all that now. Young bowler comes through. They get picked. We can test them in the nets. We go, okay, they're fine. Occasionally, maybe 1 in 7, they do it. If you do it 1 in 7 times, that's a free hit. 1 in 7 balls, we can't pick you. If you do it 1 in 24 balls, okay, we can get there. It's no different than overstepping. It is a no ball. And we have somehow completely just screwed this up in cricket, which, you know, we do. ABCD says UV70 off 30 versus Australia in the semi-final, or Virat's 82 versus 53 versus Pakistan. UVs, maybe? I don't have strong views on either of those innings. really? Aman says, if a bowler attempts a man cat and somehow misses the stumps and the ball goes loose, can the batter run? I would assume so. Yes, because the ball is live at that point. So, yes. Bowlers are usually standing next to the stumps, so it's probably unlikely that the ball is going to go masses away because they're usually going to hit it with their hand. But yes, I would think that is the case because the ball is live. I've never seen it happen, but I've never seen anyone miss the stumps on a man cat. Actually, maybe I have seen, but I've never seen it like go miles away, I should say. Rahul says, commentators use this phrase, bowling into the pitch. It makes no sense at all. If you don't bowl into the pitch, you're either bowling a full toss or a no ball. So what they are talking about here, Rahul, is there are balls that hit the pitch and skid on. There are balls that are placed on the pitch and float and are floated up. And then there are bowlers who actually try and hit the surface and get the ball to do something out of the surface. So all balls hit the pitch, as you said, other than full tosses. But you're not always trying to hit the pitch hard when you bowl. So Freddie Flintoff was a bowler who every time he bowled a ball, the vast majority of his deliveries, he was bowling into the surface to try and get the ball to hit the surface and do something as it came out. Whereas Kemar Roach is floating the ball up and he's not really all that worried about the surface other than the fact he hopes occasionally the ball will hit the seam and do something. He's trying to float it up to get it to swing. So you've got one guy who's a hit the pitch bowler and you've got one guy who is more a floaty swing type of bowler in that kind of way. Ishant Sharma quite often, probably went from a hit the pitch bowler to more of a pitch it up kind of bowler. It has to do with your height or your strength. You know, it's very hard for short guys to be hit the pitch bowlers. They usually are more skiddy bowlers. But that's what they're talking about. Kratos says, what do you think Shamar Joseph's ceiling is compared to Mayank Yadav? Mayank is faster and more accurate, but Shamar has that skiddy Marshall energy off the pitch. I think Shamar has more lateral movement, I think would be the more interesting thing of those at the moment. So it's the combination of, and this guy, the skiddy Marshall energy off the pitch that Crater is talking about is what we're talking about there is Shamar Joseph does not hit the pitch. Whereas, Mark Wood definitely hits the pitch. So different kinds of bowlers do different kinds of things, even if they're at a similar kind of height. I think it's a sideways movement that is the most interesting thing for Shamar Joseph. It's the fact that he can do that. But you're right, Mike Yadav has a lot of good skills, but if he isn't in control of lateral movement, he's then a fast bowler who's accurate. Is that maybe more of a Mark Wood type of bowler? Whereas a fast bowler who can move the ball both ways is an absolute handful for their career. Even if they're not particularly accurate, they're probably always going to be a handful. So Gus says, and thank you for the super chat, and thank you to ABCD for his super chat. Do analysts get enough respect from coaches, players? Are there difficult players who refuse to listen to analysts? Who's been the hardest for you? Look, it's different from relationship to relationship. I found with the younger players that I had a uniform on and the coach was chatting to me and the captain would come over and ask me stuff, that younger players just assumed that I must know what I was doing because other people were listening to me and I had a uniform on and, I had a job title. older players, it's hard. A lot of them made their way without analysts. And so you're coming in to tell them stuff and like, I know more than you. And I'm like, I never said you don't. In fact, I would love, as an analyst, the first thing that I want to do would be to crack your head open. I would love to get you talking about cricket for 8 hours straight and get as much information that we can then run through the system and see where you're right, where you're wrong. Because every time I've been in a situation where I've had a player who's open about, you know, things that they notice on the field, you usually get that. I've got respect from all of the coaches I have played with, I've been with, but they've hired me. Brad Hodge didn't know me beforehand, but me and Hodge got on pretty well. Players, I've had massive respect for players. I've had other players who don't respect me at all. The difficult players who don't refuse to listen to analysts, yes, but you have the coach and you have the captain. Here's the information. You guys do with it as you will. Not as an analyst, you're not always directly working with players anyway. It depends on the position and the role and how you work with the team. Who's been the hardest for you? I think there were some players of which, and my situation's different, Sega, just because I was a former journalist and some of those players had a bias against me because of things I'd written about them, right? That's fair. It's a weird situation. I used to write about them critically and now I'm in there telling them and they don't think I'm on their side. I think most of the players, there's some personal stuff, right, that has been some issues. So I think I've talked about this before, but, you know, the Scotland issue was a big one where I was really upfront that I'd written this big long piece on Scotland and, you know, it was quite divisive within the Scottish cricket community. And then I was offered the job and I said, as long as you guys know I've written this piece, they're like, no, it won't be a problem. That's the kind of honesty we want. But I don't think the players were told. So there are a few players who didn't like what I'd written there. And I probably didn't have as solid a relationship with them. Certainly at the start, and you had to earn that. And that's, you know, a normal thing in a work environment. There are other players that I'd written about before that I don't think I had a brilliant relationship with when I was working with them. I think that's probably fair to say. But again, a lot of it is personal stuff and where they come from and everything, you know, how they are in the game. Generally, once I sat down and actually talked to people, I think they got it. But they came with a bias against me without knowing much about me. I think me and Mitch McClenaghan probably was the relationship I found the hardest. And it was really interesting because I was really fascinated by him, with him as a cricketer. And I thought we'd get along really well. And it just didn't happen. Right. And, we haven't really chatted much since I worked together. So I don't know how he would think about it now and how I would think about it going back, but it would be, you know, it'd be interesting if we did it. Also, some of his stuff was valid. Like I was leading bowling meetings when I wasn't expecting to lead bowling meetings and I didn't have all the data I needed to be able to help them. And I didn't have any video. I couldn't show them. So they're having to trust me. And I didn't know how to do any of that. So a lot of the stuff that Mitch McClenaghan probably was like, why am I listening to this guy, is probably quite valid at that stage. Whereas I learned more in the first 2 weeks of that job than I probably have about being an analyst any other way. And a lot of it was the ability to talk to players and what they needed to hear. I didn't know what they needed to hear because I'd never worked with them before. So there's a relationship that I think, Mitch is retired now, but, you know, if he was playing now, he would probably see me as a very different person. And he's probably worked with way more analysts since me as well. And so that would be different for him. And he would have, and he might say, this is what I want from an analyst. And some, there were some players I would say were difficult because they didn't want to deal with it. But sometimes they would just say they were difficult in that they just, this is what I need. Can you do this? And if you could do it, it was great. And if you couldn't, it didn't work. So I think there are probably many analysts who don't get listened to. I was in a different kind of position because of where I came in the game and a lot of the people in there knew me and had followed my work or knew of my, you know, of what I had done. And sometimes that went in a great way and sometimes that went in a horrible way. And so my position is slightly different. I think there's a lot of analysts that work in cricket who are great at maths or coding, but don't have the interpersonal skills or the cricket knowledge or the loud voice that I have. And so I just not listened to because of that. I think anyone who has ever followed any of my podcasts will know, or any of my broadcasting will know, that I'm a hard person to ignore. You may hate me and you may disagree with me, but I'm probably going to put my stuff over in a way that you're at least going to have to listen to it, even if you disagree with it. I think the bigger problem with a lot of analysts is that they don't have that stuff to them. You know, it's just not who they are. And quite often they're really, really young, really, really underpaid. And a former player says, that's rubbish. A coach says, that's rubbish. Or a player says, that's rubbish. And they have nowhere, they just sort of agree with them. Some of the worst analysis I've seen has been done by analysts who don't really believe it for coaches who have told them to look up something that they know isn't true, that won't matter, you know? I've had that as well with one of the bowling coaches I work with who got me to come up with some stats. And I gave them to him and I said, look, I can give you these stats, but they mean absolutely nothing. And he said, I know. He said, but I want my bowlers to focus on the first ball and the last ball of the over. And he said, I know that the mass doesn't make any difference, but I want them to think that the first ball and the last ball are the two most important balls. Even if you can tell me they are not any more important than the second ball or the fourth ball. And it was a coaching thing. And I gave him the numbers and he used them and that's fine. But there was an honesty between the two of us there. Whereas sometimes you go and you tell them and they're just like, no, this does make sense. We do need to know these numbers. And I'm like, okay, but they don't mean anything. those sorts of issues happen. Anyway, that's it for me on the wagon wheel this week. Go over to goodareas.co. We've had the power list come up. We've got a video on Suresh Raina coming up and we've got more varied content coming up after that as well. I'm trying to think what the other... Oh, Partharana. I think we've got a video on Partharana this week. We've got some really cool stuff as well. Some really good podcasts as well on Red Inca that some of which are already up on this channel, but the rest will be on the audio channel and will come across at a later date. I don't think the Mark Butcher one will come up on this channel just because there's no video to it. But it's a really good one if you want to see it out. But thank you again to everyone for their support and everyone who showed up in the comments today. And I will see you again next time here on Wagon Wheel. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Baram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minvo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minvo.pro now.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Do you know about all the musical genres that were created by Black musicians? Like jazz, rock and roll, and folk music, to name a few. This Black Music Month, State Farm is celebrating the cultural impact and influence of music created and inspired by Black innovators. Next time you're enjoying a song, trace it back to its origins and see for yourself. Check out the Black Music Forever station on Pandora, brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.